Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm still Ben Rhodes.
Ben, so good to see you again and to be back in the USA.
Welcome back to the USA.
I was in France.
It's nice.
It was bookended by some political events. I was there for the parliamentary elections.
I was there for the presidential election, so we kind of covered.
Maybe you and I were both interfering. We were doing a little
foreign interference.
passing out thumb drives. It was interesting because I got home and all the coverage here was all about Le Pen and the far right success, but the coverage in France were just brutal headlines for Macron. It was like the headlines were like ungovernable, and one was just the slap, and it was all like very sad photos of like part of his head looking down. But yeah, it was then bookended by the Dobbs ruling, and I could hear people walking around in the streets talking about how fucked up it was, which was embarrassing.
It's always embarrassing to be an American when shit like that happens. But I mean, with Macron, what's interesting is that like you could sense it, like there was like obviously relief that he beat Le Pen, but people wanted him to like suffer, you know, politically.
Yeah they did.
They didn't want him to feel like he was validated by getting reelected, and that's kind of what I took away from that.
Yeah, and you know, it was also nice that, you know, just walking around the street in Paris and looked at my phone, and there was a tweet from him basically condemning the United States for the Dobbs ruling and for backsliding on Roe. So we're going to talk about all of this today. We're going to talk about abortion rights around the world. We're going to talk about some major updates from Ukraine and Russia, including the key news from the G7 and the NATO summit that's happening as we speak. WNBA star Brittany Griner's ongoing detention, the earthquake in Afghanistan, the horrific death of dozens of migrants near the southern border, a crackdown on free speech in India, and then last minute addition here, Ben, we got to talk about today's just explosive January 6th committee hearing. Never seen anything like that.
No, that's a new one for me.
That was a new one too.
President lunging at his Secret Service detail.
And trying to choke out his Secret Service.
Trying to lead the violent coup.
You know, this is not the most important point, but like of the people you should probably not try to choke out, like Secret Service agents pretty high up there.
The person like charged with protecting your life, I mean, just shows you that's someone who's really popped whatever screws they have left.
It creates a kind of a philosophical question of if the person who's you are charged with saving their life tries to kill you, what do you do there? I feel like I'm in philosophy 101. It's like
what's interesting to me about it too is that he clearly wanted the Secret Service to function like some like presidential guard in some dictatorship, you
very
know?
Much
where like they don't carry out an institutional role. They're just kind of like a Roman emperor's guard that like takes on his enemies and like lets armed people come in. I mean, we'll get to it, but
absolutely right.
The world though angle is that, you know, this is what happens in other places.
It's sort of like, imagine if we were watching these hearings in the UK and any G7 country and what we would be saying.
Yep.
But Ben, before we get to that, if you're looking for a fantastic new podcast, check out Crooked Media's editor-in-chief and the host of Rubicon, Brian Beutler's new show, Positively Dreadful. You know Brian, you know his tweets. You know that he can be a little bit of a half-glass empty guy. This is his attempt to find some hope. And the first episode is fantastic. He's joined by Representative Jamie Raskin to talk about, you know, the loss of his son and the insurrection and how that changed him and how to balance realism and hope today. It's a great show. New episodes of Positively Dreadful premiere each Friday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts. By the way, if you're not listening to Mother Country Radicals.
I am.
You are only hurting yourself, that's listener.
Don't hurt yourself.
Out there who hasn't subscribed and downloaded these two shows yet, I know. I can actually see it on your phone right now. So click over, hit pause.
Well, this is like a Snowden throwback.
Yeah, I'm Snowdening everyone. More importantly, look, we talk about Roe a ton in this episode. You're angry. We're angry. Let's actually do something about it. So there's a ton you can do. You can support patients who need abortions right now. We can elect pro-choice candidates in 2022. We can build progressive majorities over the long term through organizing. Everything you want, all the resources you need, all the organizations that you can get involved with to help are available at votesaveamerica.com/Roe, R-O-E. Again, votesaveamerica.com/Roe. Check it out. Lastly, I'm going to talk with Peter Beinart about President Biden's upcoming trip to the Middle East and all the human rights considerations it raises. So stick around for that as well. All right. So Ben, in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe, we want to talk about just how much of an outlier this makes the United States when it comes to abortion rights. I mentioned President Macron's statement criticizing the decision. He was far from the only one. Boris Johnson, Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the UK, called the ruling a big step backwards. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called it horrific. There were protests across Europe. these are our closest allies, right? I mean, and then, you know, just some numbers. Of the 36 countries that the United Nations defines as developed economies, all but Poland and Malta allowed abortion at a woman's request until Friday. Now we are grouped with Poland and Malta on this list of countries that have far lesser rights. It's a little more sense of sort of like abortion access globally. Most European countries allow abortion within the first trimester. Last year, Mexico's Supreme Court unanimously ruled that it's unconstitutional to penalize abortion. We talked about this in the past on the show. In 2020, Argentina legalized abortion in the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. Japan allows abortion in cases of rape or risk to the woman's health, but has some very backwards rules requiring women to get their spouse's consent to obtain an abortion. Obviously, in the Middle East and in large parts of the continent of Africa, there are some pretty severe restrictions on abortions. The Center for Reproductive Rights has a great map if you want more details. But here's the key point. The U.S. is backsliding on abortion rights, and that now puts us in the company of a number of authoritarian countries that already have severe restrictions or are also backsliding as well. So, you know, Ben, the U.S. is about to balkanize in terms of abortion access. But I mean, like, you pointed out this connection. Like, how are you feeling about sliding to this slot next to Poland when it comes to access to basic human rights like healthcare? And like, how do you think that ties into this broader crackdown on human rights and freedom we've seen in Poland and some of these places?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really important. First of all, it's just kind of notable when your companies like, you know, Poland and I think Nicaragua has taken steps to roll back abortion rights recently. But what it speaks to is, you know, where governments think that they can take away fundamental human rights, like they are moving in an anti-democratic direction. In both Poland and the United States, there's a religious component in introduced to it. Like Poland, it's a right-wing Christian government. And, you know, same thing here. We have a constitution that does not have the word God in the constitution. And now we're using, you know, essentially what is a religious movement? Let's face it. It's, you know, it's not originalism. That's a legal justification for like an effort to impose other people's religious views on the majority.
It's white Christian nationalism.
Yeah. And so I think the core point to step back and think about this is you have a minority imposing its will on the majority in service of like a white Christian nationalist ideology, right? And that is a piece of democratic backsliding. You know, it's taking away rights, but it's also enshrining a kind of minoritarian view, you know, where the minority, this court represents the views of kind of about a third of the country. And yet in all aspects of American life going forward, they can impose their will on the majority. So that the democratic deficit place that we find ourselves in that's really frightening is we have a court that could be in place for decades that clearly feels no restraint in moving into different areas of people's lives, whether it's guns, abortion, the environment, voting rights, all these areas.
Contraception, gay marriage.
Pretty fundamental areas to like American life where they are now feeling like the views of minority should be more important than the views of the majority. And that's a democratic crisis. And that's how we describe it if it was happening in Poland or any other country.
I'm so anxious for when the Supreme Court rules on this climate change case and what it could mean for our ability to just get anything done.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to set up this perennial situation where you're going to have like local and state fights with the federal government on just whether you can act responsibly. And then one thing I'd say globally, I'm glad that you highlighted some of the access issues in places like Japan, because even in France, like, okay, if Macron wants to get on the right side of this, there's a lot that could be done to increase access to reproductive health care and equity around reproductive health care. So maybe if we're going to awaken like the linkage between abortion rights, reproductive health care, and human rights and democracy, maybe like the good that could come out of it in other countries is fortifying and expanding the right.
France actually, you know, some lawmakers put forward legislation to enshrine respect for abortion into the country's constitution. So yeah. I think some lawmakers are seeing this sort of right-wing wave coming and trying to get ahead of it.
Get ahead of it, yeah.
Okay, that is, you know, incredibly dark and an issue we're going to keep following. You know, President Biden, you know, sort of responded to this decision out of the court and then had to jet off to Europe. So we're going to cover that now. He is there for G7 and NATO meetings where the focus is Russia and Ukraine. The G7 wrapped its meetings in Germany on Tuesday at some lovely Bavarian.
Looked like some Bavarian spa or
something. It was like Sound of Music or something. Yeah. So the G7, by the way, is Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the US, and the UK. The big headline coming out of that summit is that the nations are going to explore imposing a price cap on purchases of Russian oil. As we've all experienced at this point, gas prices are through the roof. imposing a cap on the price of Russian oil would ensure that the Russians are profiting off of the war, because even as the Russian oil export volumes have fallen, their revenue has climbed thanks to higher prices. This is an idea that's been kicking around for a while. The details have not been worked out. It's going to take a while to figure it out. But these leaders also pledged to spend $4.5 billion to counter food shortages as a result of the war. There was also the mandatory family photo ban of the leaders before this mountain. Now, they looked a little disheveled. I don't know if you noticed this.
Looked like they like had a few drinks. Some of them had a few drinks. Like the giveaway is that, you know, some people drink and some don't.
Yeah.
So like Joe Biden, not a drinker.
Not a drinker.
He looked like normal.
Tie was on.
Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson looked like he'd just been in a lockdown party in number 10.
Twitter told me it was a post-dinner photo. And I'm just going to say, Boris Johnson looked like he was eight Rieslings deep. You know, he had been just slocked.
Now we know what was going on, you know, during the pandemic.
Like, Question for you besides that. Do you think that this price cap, this oil price cap idea, it's kind of a tacit admission that Western energy sanctions kind of haven't worked and that they are hurting foreign consumers more than the Russian government if you've got these revenues up, or any other G7 hot takes?
Yeah, I think that is true in the sense that when, you know, because of the war itself, right, and so like the responsibilities with Putin, and then obviously the sanctions become part of that picture, that's driving up the price of oil. So the stuff that Putin is still able to sell, even though he can't sell to as many customers, is bringing in greater revenue. And we've seen these reports of the Chinese kind of backfilling, and even the Indians backfilling some of the sales of oil. And so that leaves you with what options? It leaves you with, you know, the diplomatic efforts to try to stop other nations like China and India from backfilling that oil, and then trying to manage as best you can their capacity to drive up the price, you know, in those sales. But I think we have to be honest, like it's going to be quite hard, you know, to like manipulating the global price of energy is not something that even the G7 can really do. If this can make any positive difference around the margins, good, by all means, try everything. But I think we should not have overly high expectations about how much you can accomplish this way. I think the food issue, on the other hand, was really glad to see them focusing on that, because they really can make up some of the difference in like grain and other goods that are going off the market. So hopefully they can blunt that, not just an inflation issue, but more like a humanitarian issue.
Yes, that is a huge issue that's going to get it even more problematic very soon. So Biden, I think, is probably en route to Spain right now for the NATO meetings. The allies will reportedly discuss ways to bolster defenses in, you know, Eastern Bloc NATO countries, the closest countries to Russia. And they're also going to decide whether to increase this NATO quick reaction force from 40,000 troops to 300,000, so an eightfold increase, pretty significant. And they will also likely try to make progress on pushing forward Finland and Sweden's bids to join NATO. Turkey been the holdup there. There's some reports just before we started recording that may have been resolved. I'm not sure if it's totally resolved yet. U.S. officials say the U.S. will buy Ukraine a new advanced missile defense system. There was a report in the Times over the weekend, Ben, about just how much Western troops and intelligence agencies are in Ukraine, helping Ukrainian troops, providing them with intelligence support. The piece talks about how most of this activity is happening outside of Ukraine, but there are a few dozen NATO troops working inside Ukraine, along with U.S. CIA officers who are mostly in Kiev, coordinating intelligence support. So none of this was surprising necessarily. I think you and I both early on talked about our assumption that there was probably like some sort of covert side of the war and this sort of stuff happening. But the NATO meeting, the details in that Time story, I do think it shows again, like every time we talk about this, we're deeper in the fight. There's more ways it could escalate. It's a bit unnerving.
Yeah. I think that there's structural things that are happening, and then there's like the tactical things in the war itself. I think it's worth stepping back and considering just some of the big structural changes that are happening in kind of the global order in the last few days and weeks. Like, so you had the EU come out and announce that it's extending EU candidacy membership to Ukraine and Moldova. Mm-hmm. It's a big change,
big deal,
right? Like,
yeah,
the big deal. It might take a while for Ukraine to get in the EU, but like when you consider that the starting point for this whole crisis in 2014 was, you know, a protest movement in Ukraine that chased out a corrupt Russian puppet because they wanted to be closer to Europe, that's a big step. Then you have Finland and Sweden, you know, beginning the process of joining NATO, and it does seem like they reached some trilateral understanding with Turkey, whatever the transaction was for Erdogan, somebody paid it.
Yeah, somebody probably paid off his kid or something, who knows.
Big structural change there, Finland and Sweden coming to NATO.
You sound like Elizabeth Warren when you said it.
Big structural change, right?
That's good.
And then you have on the energy side, even some of the G7 conversations about moving Europe off of Russian energy dependency, really kind of moving them a little closer to the U.S. too. That, that's a big structural shift. So this is changing the global order in ways that are bad for Russia, right?
Yep.
NATO, the EU, who the supplier of European energy is. But then on the tactical level, it's harder because the Russians are making these kind of incremental inch-by-inch gains.
Yeah.
And there, I think the question is, that Times article speaks to probably a big distinction within NATO, where there's some countries that like literally have commandos in Ukraine, according to that article. Not
yes.
the U.S., but other countries,
yeah.
it said, had special forces. The U.S. has CIA in there. We're providing, you know, battlefield-relevant intelligence. There's, like, Ukrainian military units with, like, tablets.
Using U.S., yeah, tablets. Yeah,
like an iPad, basically,
to target,
you know, to target Russians. Like, that's in the fight, right? And you have the U.S. moving some of these longer-range artillery, and then clearly other NATO countries not doing it. So what we won't get public readouts of the NATO summit on is the brass tacks of like, okay, who's going to be pouring in the heavy weapons and who's worried? I'm sure some voices are raising caution about like, hey, like if we're like broadcasting the New York Times that we're giving battlefield intelligence to kill Russians and all these weapons and CIA, and you know, you are living with a permanent state of some degree of risk of escalation.
Yeah. And so look, I mean, and to that point, I mean, Putin greeted the G7 by launching a missile strike on a shopping center with apparently more than 1,000 people inside of it. He also struck Kiev several times, including a kindergarten playground. So Putin is just stacking up war crimes at this point. The fight, as you mentioned, in the eastern Ukraine is just a war of attrition. I've seen estimates of up to 200 Ukrainian casualties per day. And the artillery fire and fighting is so relentless that I was listening to a podcast where experts were debating whether the Russian military might actually run out of shells at some point. Spoiler alert, it's like not for a year. So unfortunately, that's not going to be our solution here. But you know, you've got these more sophisticated U.S. and NATO weapon systems getting incorporated into the fight as soon as the Ukrainians can get trained up to use them. But again, it's going to lead to incremental gains and you know, take time to affect the outcome. I did see that President Zelensky reportedly told the G7 leaders that he wants the war to be over by the end of the year because he's worried about the cold making it, you know, the conditions, I guess, even harder for his troops, and that he doesn't want to negotiate with Russia until they've consolidated the Ukrainian positions. Ben, you know, I think where Zelensky's coming from here, but that is going to be just a horrific 6 months. I mean, for the Ukrainian people, for the countries dealing with these food shortages we mentioned earlier, for energy consumers all over the world. I mean, that's 6 months is a slog.
Yeah, and you could have a situation where precisely because of that attrition, you know, the Russians push a little bit further and then they kind of stop. Right. Mm-hmm. Because they need to replenish and they need to like let their forces rest. But then they kind of resume again, you know, once at a time of their choosing. And meanwhile, the Ukrainians don't appear like they want to negotiate in a position where they've lost more territory. Yeah. Right. And so I think you're going to have the main question here is different timelines. Like Putin's got his own timeline, which is clearly designed to take as much Ukrainian territory as he can and divide the West through this attrition. Zelensky is trying to find a moment where they have some success, probably, just like Putin is, in taking back some area, but he's going to need a lot of heavy weapons for that. And then the U.S. and NATO has this timeline of, like, at a certain point, you try to push for diplomacy here. And those timelines are not converging.
No.
And I think what happens is you get towards the end of the year, the food shortages become more acute, political instability spreading because of food shortages, elections start to, you know, have consequences from the inflationary pressure. This is going to get harder before it gets any better.
You know? The politics are going to get way harder, especially for, I think, for President Biden.
Yeah.
Staying in Russia for a minute on a separate topic, we saw WNBA star Brittany Griner for the first time in a while this week. She appeared in a Russian court Monday, roughly 4.5 months after she was arrested for allegedly being in possession of vape cartridges containing cannabis oil in Russia. At that hearing, she was ordered to remain in Russian custody for the duration of her trial, and her detention was extended for 6 months. So if convicted, Griner could face up to 10 years in prison. So, you know, Ben, it's been hard to watch this slowly, evolve? I mean, clearly this is a hostage situation. It has been for a while. Griner was arrested just after the Russian invasion. The State Department now has the special presidential envoy for hostage affairs handling the case. You got the Russian media speculating about her getting traded in a hostage swap for Viktor Bout, who is this notorious arms dealer, supported terrorist, is serving 25 years in prison. You and I mean, we didn't really talk about the case much on this show initially because everyone was saying people around her were asking folks not to really talk about it. They're trying to resolve it quietly. Obviously, that calculus has changed. So I just wanted to talk about it today to, like, you know, sort of acknowledge her plight, her struggle that her family is going through. There was this awful story about her wife trying to contact her through the State Department. No one was there to answer the phone. And I'm just very worried about how this gets resolved.
Yeah. And this is, you know, like, this is arguably the greatest or one of the greatest basketball players in the world, right? And very prominent American. And I think what, you know, the specific charge is the kind of thing that, you know, you have to think, okay, would the Russians have really detained her and held her? That, you know, I don't know what the facts are around that, but, like, would they have really gone through with detaining this very prominent person for a pretty minor offense or allegation absent the geopolitical circumstances? And that was the question that was kind of unclear at the beginning, because what you want to do is quietly resolve this. And, you know, and that clearly didn't happen. And now that this is in the public eye, and now that you have the, you know, these kind of noises out of Russia around exchanges, well, suddenly that's no longer like a normal legal process. If they're talking about exchanges and stuff, and that's percolating up, suddenly it's using this person as leverage at a time when the U.S. government has very little means of affecting that beyond some kind of exchange. And we saw the exchange before for the other American who was held inside of Russia. So it's a scary moment for her and her family and her wife. Like, it was just a horrific story about not being able, you know, someone not being at their desk essentially when she was supposed to be connected for the first time by phone to Brittany Griner. So it's one of these things where there's no good options for the U.S. government, because it's probably either wait and see or like a really unpalatable exchange that kind of validates the hostage shaking, right? So it's a perennial challenge.
And probably Putin wants to maintain some sort of leverage wherever he can.
Yeah, just any little bit he can get, you know.
He's just a monster. Pod Save the World is brought to you by AG1. It is now easier than ever to start your day off right with 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens in a single scoop of AG1. AG1 is an NSF certified for sport. No clue what that means. The gold standard for professional athletes who have to adhere to strict rules regarding supplements and nutritional products. They answered it for me. It's good enough for them. It's good enough for me. I love AG1. I've been using it for years now. It doesn't taste super healthy. Love it.
It doesn't.
This is not wheatgrass.
It's not wheatgrass.
It's a mild tropical taste. I look forward to it. I add it to my smoothies every day that I have a smoothie. And you don't get
every day that he has a smoothie.
All the time. Love the smoothies. No jitteriness, no, like a coffee will do. The same mental clarity and alertness. That's when I reach for my jar of AG1. Recommended by professional athletes with over 7,000 five-star reviews. This is high nutritional value in its most convenient format. Athletic Greens wants you to know it's not just for athletes. It's for anyone that believes if you start strong, it's easier to finish that way. It's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. Just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills or supplements like your grandma used to take. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/world. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/world to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Turning to Afghanistan, because there was a devastating earthquake there last week that killed at least 1,000 people injured thousands more and destroyed more than 10,000 homes. On Tuesday, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, said that the U.S. will provide $55 million in aid for Afghanistan. But obviously, that's not going to cover it. And, you know, I think we both wanted to raise this because this disaster underscores a couple of things. First, the Taliban can't govern.
No.
We never, right? Yeah. They have no infrastructure and to adequately respond. There were reports of them dispatching, like, religious leaders to areas where people needed food and medical help. I mean, it's just a disaster. And then two, I mean, it underscores again the just horribly, unbelievably dire situation that nearly half the country is in. I mean, there's like 19 million people who are struggling to find food on the brink of famine. And, you know, none of us like the Taliban. Their rule is as bad as expected. The rights of women are being trampled on. People who worked with the West are being murdered. But, you know, I guarantee you that Taliban leaders are eating well, you know what I mean? And average people are starving to death. And so I don't know. I just hope that maybe this can be a moment where the U.S. and other countries rethink the current sanctions regime. There's some reporting in The Washington Post today that Biden's team is having talks with the Taliban about releasing some of Afghanistan's seized bank reserves. But it just feels like this is very urgent and U.S. sanctions are hurting innocent people.
It does. I mean, this natural disaster like compounds like a dire humanitarian circumstance that we have something to do with. We have something to do with it for the decades of war. Mm. We have something to do with it because of the withdrawal. We have something to do with it because of the sanctions. And I just see no strategic, tactical, or moral reason for these sanctions because you always have to think about what is the objective behind them.
What are we trying to do?
The objective isn't just to show that we don't like the Taliban. There are a lot of people we don't like around the world.
We try to kill them for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of people we don't like around the world. Like, we don't sanction everybody we don't like. And the reality is, are these sanctions having any influence whatsoever on the Taliban and their behavior? Well, no. And if fighting a war for two decades against the Taliban didn't influence their behavior, I don't know why, like, some economic sanctions would. And the reality is, like you said, it's clearly not hurting them. It's not preventing them from being in power. If the U.S. fighting a war didn't prevent them from being in power, the sanctions aren't going to do that. And meanwhile, you are hurting ordinary Afghans, and you're making it harder to get assistance to them. You're just generally hurting the economic circumstances in the country. And so as strange it may seem, like, it's not like you're lifting sanctions on the Taliban. You're lifting sanctions on the Afghan people who are being punished because they're governed by the Taliban, you know? And I think that this earthquake highlights the fact that, like, these people have suffered enough. Our policy should be about, yes, maintaining our counterterrorism interests there. It should also basically be about how can we make life a little bit better for the Afghan people.
Yeah, the Afghan people who are hurting because the Taliban are in power because Trump cut a deal with them.
Yeah.
To basically get us here.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. had something to do with. Like, that's a really good point you make, right? Like, if Trump makes a deal with the Taliban to kind of bring them in from the cold, Joe Biden de facto goes along with that deal by completing the withdrawal, in part on the logic that that was the deal. If we will deal with the Taliban to kind of help facilitate their return to politics and then say, but we're going to keep all these sanctions, there's an illogic to that.
Yeah,
you know?
Trump called the Taliban leader. Yeah. Mike Pompeo was meeting with these guys in
Mike
Qatar.
Mike Pompeo was like hanging out with these guys in Qatar.
I mean, the Obama administration was negotiating with them. Like, look, it's time to move on from this disastrous regime. To continue down this sort of pretty dark little section here of U.S.
Unfortunately,
policies.
Unfortunately, the war is like not, the world is not collaborating with the lightness.
Yeah, no, it's not. And nor is this next story. I mean, sort of U.S. policies leading to humanitarian disasters. There are reports on Monday, 50 migrants were found dead in the back of a tractor trailer in San Antonio, Texas. And it's believed that all of them were left there by smugglers, that these individuals were originally from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras. It's not the first time that authorities have found like a gruesome mass grave like this, where people were essentially baked alive in the back of an 18-wheeler in someplace like Texas or Arizona. And I raise this to just remind everyone how, you know, desperate people are to get to the United States, how broken the immigration system has been for decades, and how that empowers smugglers who have no regard for human life. And this is the cost. You know what I mean? These are the people who pay the consequences. It's not just about politics or the border or Title 42. It's like human beings, women, children, in the back of this truck, in the most agonizing death you could imagine.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, and we've already done on abortion, but one of the things that we can do on this show is like to try to look at the United States from the perspective of a different country in the same way that we look at events in other countries. And I said to you, Tommy, when I saw this news, I thought about how we in America sometimes look at the refugee crisis in Europe, right?
Yes.
And we think of it as something different than our southern border, right? So when we hear about migrants drowning in the Mediterranean or people trapped in containers on ships because human traffickers put them there and suffocating and families dying, we think of this as like a refugee crisis for Europe. But the reality is like we have a southern border that is totally broken. We have people, some of whom are political refugees, they're leaving political violence, some of them whom are coming for economic reasons, some of whom are coming because they want to be reunited with our families. But because we've not been permitted to rationalize and fix our border and our immigration system for decades, because like the Republican Party would rather weaponize like a broken border than actually try to pass laws to, because you should be setting up orderly processes for like, how do you process political asylum claims? Like, what is the pace of legal migration? Like, how do you deal with family reunification? Because those things are not being dealt with through the law and through like additional resources for things like asylum judges, you are empowering the human traffickers who can profit. And you know, the only thing you're counting on to prevent atrocities like this is, you know, either catching the human trafficking networks or just hoping that they're more humane. Like,
yeah,
this is
luck.
Not sustainable, right? And these are families. Like, picture your kids in those conditions. Like, literally
170 degrees.
Being baked to death.
In the back,
you know,
of an
18-wheeler. Like, it's unfathomable humanitarian tragedy. And the last thing I want to say is, like, did you see the Greg Abbott statement?
No.
Greg Abbott tweets, the governor of Texas, Joe Biden, this is on you, right? And, like, just, like, it's your fault because you blah, blah, blah. And it's, like, imagine that that's your first reaction. You're the governor of a state where dozens of people, you know, ordinary people were found dead. And your first reaction is like, Joe Biden, this is on you. Like, these people have lost their fucking minds, never mind their moral compass.
It's just so dehumanizing. I mean, we almost...
Yeah, it's using these people as a prop.
Yeah, we almost have to laugh about, like, the Republicans who are like, oh, you know, caravans are coming to the border with Ebola and ISIS, right? Like, that literally happened. But it is, you know, it's completely dehumanizing. It's making people into isms. It's making it all about fear. And that Abbott statement folds right into that.
Yeah.
Politics and fear.
Yeah, and no interest in actually solving the problem.
No.
They want the border to be broken. I mean, they want this to be the mess that it is so they can demagogue it.
Yeah. The election was stolen and, you know, the craziest candidates out there, like that woman running for Carrie Lake, I think, running for Arizona governor is, you know, running on the platform of the election was stolen. We're going to send the National Guard to the border. Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I mean, wonderful. Yeah. Switching gears a little bit. Here's a story you flagged, Ben, that we should just keep an eye on. So, in India, a prominent human rights activist was arrested and faces charges of fabricating evidence against Prime Minister Narendra Modi. She had spearheaded efforts to hold a bunch of government officials accountable for sectarian riots back in 2002 that killed thousands of people, mostly Muslims. At the time, Prime Minister Modi was the governor of the region in question where this sectarian violence occurred. There has long been questions about what he did or didn't do to foment or stop the violence. I think the bigger question here and issue here, Ben, is whether this signals like a broader crackdown on by Modi on journalists, civil society, political opponents. What are you hearing from folks in India?
Well, first of all, like this question of what happened in the Gujarat riots when Modi was the governor of Gujarat is it's not like a new question.
No.
The U.S. and other governments had restrictions on Modi, travel restrictions. He was sanctioned because foreign governments thought that he was at a minimum like witting of and helped incite some of this violence, right? So this is not like some crackpot theories from some anti-Modi journalists.
No,
like
no.
The world pretty much accepted that Narendra Modi did something wrong as governor of Gujarat at this time. And it was just kind of a question of how far on the spectrum he did something wrong, right? Now, the other thing is, you know, Rana Ayyub, who we've had on this a podcast. And
fearless journalist.
A friend of mine, fearless journalist. She wrote a book called The Gujarat Files, where she literally detailed and gathered evidence around Modi and his circle's complicity here. And part of what you're seeing in India is this kind of massive uptick, steady uptick, really, of the demonization of Muslims and the kind of takeover of the apparatus of the state by the Modi government. And they're kind of willfully beginning to target individuals like this. And I do worry about like Rana, because, you know, the same kind of, you know, crazy, I mean, the corruption of yet another Supreme Court, right? It shows you how, you know, right-wing leaders focus on the courts could be used to punish her. And the other thing I saw from Rana recently is like Twitter reached out to her and was like removing some of her content because it violated like the Indian government's restrictions around publicizing some of this stuff, right?
Great.
And so Elon Musk, all the free speech stands on Twitter, like, do you care about the fact that this is being used to weaponize the targeting of journalists and activists in India? Like, where's the free speech crowd when it's a right-wing nationalist who's the one seeking to stamp out the free speech? Because that's what you see is this broad crackdown on Muslims, on journalism, on civil society in India, and it just doesn't get a lot of attention because there's some geopolitical discomfort in spotlighting Modi as someone who's violating these norms.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure that people like Elon Musk and others want to do big business.
I bet Tesla's got a lot of business there. Yeah. So it's a good,
or at least they want to.
If Mr. Free Speech Elon Musk, will he put his free speech advocacy above whatever business interest he has in that very large market? I don't know. I'm not hopeful.
Time will tell. Yeah. My guess is no. So you're right, Ben, that, you know, there are these sort of lingering questions about Modi's role in the Gujarat riots. I'd say that after today, there are fewer questions about Trump's role in the insurrection in January 6th.
Good transition.
I mean,
very
fucking
good transition.
So there were a bunch of other issues we wanted to cover today. We were going to talk about Boris Johnson threatening to tear up part of the post-Brexit trade deal that he signed with the EU, these ongoing protests in Ecuador, this horrific attack on the LGBT community in Oslo, Norway. But then we watched these hearings, and I just feel like we have to discuss what happened, because frankly, if these, like you said at the top, I mean, these events were happening in another country, we would fear for the future of that country as a democracy.
Yes, yeah.
It was like, it was one of the craziest 2 hours I've ever seen. The sole witness was a woman named Cassidy Hutchinson, who worked for then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows at the White House. Quick summary, I'm just going to do a couple of these. We'll pause to talk about them. We'll do some more. I mean, so maybe the wildest anecdote we learned was that Trump was so desperate to go up to the Capitol on January 6th that he tried to grab the wheel of the presidential limo from a Secret Service agent. And when he was restrained, he choked the guy, yelling, "I'm the fucking president. Take me to the Capitol now."
Okay.
Sounds like a 2-year-old temper tantrum. Yeah. Trump knew the crowd on January 6th was armed and could turn violent, but wanted security measures loosened because, quote, "they're not here to hurt me." Mark Meadows said that Trump's reaction to hang Mike Pence, that chant, was, quote, "he thinks Mike deserves it." I mean, we could stop there, and that would be one of the most shocking hearings or things ever put under oath that I've ever heard.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to this. And the first thing I want to say is, like, we were talking before, but this witness, Cassidy Hutchinson, you know, it's important for people to understand why a 25-year-old would be, like, the most credible witness for all this.
For sure.
Because, like, that job, you work for the chief of staff, you're the aide to the chief of staff. We had the same position in the Obama White House. I'm sure Ron Klain, Biden chief of staff, has the same person now. Like, that person sees everything.
Everything. All the gossip, all the emails, the phone calls.
Always be friends with those people.
You don't fuck with those people.
You don't fuck with those people. But here's the reality. Like, there's a real estate reality and a paper reality. The real estate reality is the second floor of the West Wing has very few offices, right?
Sign.
As a national security advisor, the Oval Office, and like the White House chief of staff, and a couple of the deputy chiefs of staff, right? Which in the Trump people was like Jared.
Yeah, like defiled by Jared Kushner.
Yeah. Now, so you're on this hallway, literally, you're down the hallway from the Oval Office. So you literally see everybody's going in and out of there. Like, if the people come out and it was a bad meeting, like, you're the first desk where someone stops to gossip about it.
But also, they're all familiar with you. So they trust you. They gossip with you. They tell you what's going on. You're in a very elite little club.
You know, because you know both the senior officials, and you heard her talking about, like, Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, but you also know the valet.
And the other assistants.
Yeah, and the other assistants, and the dude that
has
to clean up the plate that Trump just flew on the floor. you know the Secret Service guys.
He barely threw his burger against the wall and there was ketchup stuck on it.
The Secret Service guys who stand there, right? Yes. And see everything, right? So, and you also see all the paper, right? Who, like, the president's schedule, the president's private schedule, like, who's trying to get in to see the president through the chief of staff. So it just set up that this woman knows exactly what the fuck
everything.
She's talking about. Everything, right?
And probably took some notes.
Yeah, well, felt that way.
Seemed like she took some notes.
Seemed like she took some notes, right? Wouldn't you, though? I mean, if you saw that
at some point,
shit,
I'd be like, I need some leverage to get out of this shit.
But then, like, what she saw was literally, okay, we've established at January 6th hearings that there was a legal process to develop the coup, right? This mm-hmm. is, like, the John Eastman thing. Then, like, there was this kind of ramp-up pressure on Mike Pence to, like, do the coup. Mm-hmm. And then when Mike Pence wouldn't do the coup, there was this backup plan to basically incite an insurrection to intimidate them to do the coup. And what we learned today is, like, Donald Trump, not only did he know that, not only was he trying to literally take the mags away so more armed people could get on the mall and march down to the Capitol, he wanted to join the violent coup.
Join them.
Like, he wanted to go, and he wanted his West Wing moment of, like, marching up the Capitol steps with the fucking QAnon shaman, whatever the fuck it is. Like, he wanted to be there
future
with those
Vice
guys
President.
With his, like, feet on Nancy Pelosi's desk. Like, this, like, how much more evidence do we need that he's guilty of trying, of, like, many, many crimes?
But also, Mark Meadows is in trouble. I mean, there's testimony that Meadows was, like, totally checked out. He's on his phone, like, playing Wordle when he's getting briefed about, like, weapons, yeah, the likelihood of violence. And then apparently he was trying to go to the insurrectionist planning meeting happening at the Willard Hotel, and then he had to get dialed into it. Mike Flynn, former National Security Advisor, yeah, Mike Flynn, pleaded the fifth when asked if violence is justified and if he believes in the peaceful transfer of power. Plead the fifth?
Kind of a weird thing.
Can't answer that. Yeah. We got the White House counsel saying he had serious legal concerns about Trump marching to the Capitol and saying, quote, we're going to get charged with every crime imaginable.
Yeah.
Lastly, we learned about ongoing efforts to intimidate witnesses by the Trump team. I mean, this fucking blockbuster hour and 55-minute hearing happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Liz Cheney's like, and by the way, sprinkle, 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 you know, little breadcrumbs for the next one. People are maybe even texting.
Yeah.
Witnesses telling them to shut up,
yeah,
in, like, Bob terms, which you're going to jail if you did that.
Oh, they'll find that text. If DOJ gets off its ass, because side note on that, like, Mark Meadows was clearly the center of all this. And the fact that DOJ decided to enforce the subpoena against Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon, your favorite podcasters.
My guy.
But not Mark Meadows.
My guys,
like,
I know.
Hello, DOJ. Like, after today, might we please enforce the subpoena on the guy who actually knows all this stuff? But the other thing is, like, to your point, like, we have the crimes. Then the other piece, the only piece you left out, Tom, is, like, all of them being like, hey, can we get pardons for all of our crimes?
Oh, yeah, right? And, like, members of Congress, too.
Meadows wanted a pardon. You don't ask for a pardon if you didn't do the crimes. And then, because they don't want to be caught having done the crimes, you have them literally trying to, like a mob boss. The messages she got that Liz Cheney dangled out there were like, you know, we know you're going to do the right thing today, and, you know, Trump is going to be watching, and if you want to stay in our good graces, like, this is like mafia shit, but that's kind of how authoritarian movements are. They run like mafias, right? Like, you need to enforce loyalty, you need to punish dissent, you know, you need to reward being a sycophantic collaborator. So it's just all on ugly display, but it was pretty well done. I mean, as you, like, maybe what they're, I mean, I'm not like a Liz Cheney stan by any stretch, but, like, telling that maybe the Democrats needed like a Cheney to come in and just
Wrecking
ball these people.
Let's,
you know,
address this Cheney thing head on. Every scholar, expert, experienced person, journalist, foreign and domestic that you read that talks about the way to fight fascism says you need to build the largest coalition possible,
yeah,
from the socialists to the never Trump Republicans. You don't have to love Liz Cheney. You don't have to like her dad or think, yeah, the war in Iraq was a good fucking idea to think she's running a good hearing. Can we all just be adults and, like, hold two things in our heads at one time and say, she's doing a pretty good job here. I hate her policies over there. I'm an adult, so I can have both those ideas.
Look, I love how you put it because, like, as someone who I'm sure you could go back and find Liz Cheney circa, like, 2014 calling me, like, an Ayatollah or,
sure,
something. Like, if I was living in 1930 Germany, and it was like if the social Democrats weren't getting along with, like, the conservatives, and it was like, we can't possibly unite with them against this guy Hitler and his crackpot group of people. Like I'm sure those people live to regret that.
Yeah.
I'd like anybody who wants to fight the fascist to be a part of the emergency movement here.
Yeah, let's
then we can
fight
get back to fighting with her about everything else in the back end.
Like we love to circle the wagons and then shoot inward.
Yeah.
We're so good at it.
The Democrats are really good at
it. It's like, yeah, oh, you want to rally against Trump? Well, you didn't support, Medicare for All being phased in 1 year instead of five. It's like, guys, come on.
Let's just let's save the democracy.
This is like real fascism.
No, this is
this
like
Trump trying to take the wheel and drive it to the Capitol.
He wanted the Secret Service to function like this Praetorian Guard. It's totally insane.
It's remarkable. I mean, I guess the question is,
Wait a second. Play out how it would have happened.
What does he do?
It's kind of interesting. Like, what if the Secret Service had been like, okay, and Trump goes up there?
And does he just march in there and say what?
I mean,
it's a big play.
I literally think it would look like Benito Mussolini, like walking up the steps of the Capitol and crossing his arms, and they're parting the seas because they do love him. It would have looked...
Didn't
like really fucking dark, and that's what he wanted.
Didn't Nayib Bukele do this? Didn't he like storm the military into Congress when he wanted some law passed?
Yeah, and it worked.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's great company you're keeping there, Don. Yeah. I mean, I do. The question now is sort of like, I don't know. We've seen like seismic testimony against Donald Trump clearly trying to conspire with the Ukrainian government to get dirt on Joe Biden and holding up military, like all these things sort of like have not gotten enough Republicans to break. The question now is whether there's blood in the water in terms of the Republican primary electorate. Like there's a lot of musings about Ron DeSantis right now. And Ben, I saw this today. Dan Pfeiffer shared this with us in an attempt to trigger us. NBC News reported that Mike Pompeo's political action committee is running a new digital ad in Iowa and South Carolina about religious freedom. So we are going to have to deal with that asshole running for president. But maybe it's a sign that they see some weakness here with Trump.
Yeah, if like noted Trump sycophant Mike Pompeo is like, taking that step, they're beginning to look past Trump, right? Mike Pompeo has an extraordinary opportunity here to potentially drive up his numbers from 1% to 1.5% in Iowa, New Hampshire.
Yeah, it's
watch
big.
It. Don't sleep on Mike, right? Like,
he didn't get that lap band surgery or whatever for no reason. Yeah, like, he's been preparing for this thing.
All that genuflection before Trump, that raising money in the State Department, the Madison dinners, the like piping into the RNC from Jerusalem, like, that might get him, that might crack 1%, right?
He is so delusional if he thinks that there is going to be a constituency for whatever it is.
Rex Tillerson could probably get more write-in votes than Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
But I do think that like it'll be interesting to watch whether something cracks here. I do want to just come back because I'm mindful of like the context of this show. National security, like think of the national security danger of the United States of America from the president of the United States of America on January 6th.
Yeah.
Relative to like, again, I know this has been said before, but like, if one ISIS terrorist tried to run into the Capitol with one weapon, like we'd all, like they'd be having hearings about that still today. Mm-hmm. Like the President of the United States wanted to lead a violent assault on American democracy.
And
Republicans are like sitting this one out.
You've made the point about all the secrets that Jared Kushner has in his head that he could sell. I mean, think about what Mike Flynn knows.
Yeah.
Every covert action program, every special access program.
Mike Pompeo,
over at the Penn. Yeah. I mean, look, Pompeo is like a terrible guy.
Yeah, but not cases like Flynn.
But like Mike Flynn is a bona fide lunatic.
Yeah, yeah. Who?
Bad hire under the Obama days. Who was it that pushed him so hard? I feel like it was like someone at the Pentagon was like, "This is the guy."
He was a star in the Pentagon.
Yeah,
yeah. No,
under like
Petraeus
or something.
It wasn't like
anybody. McChrystal.
He was a McChrystal guy. Which is interesting because
McChrystal is
a guy.
I respect him. Yeah, I really do.
But these people know a lot and. Does anybody think that Mike Flynn's not sharing that knowledge with like the likes of Steve Bannon?
Yeah. Great. Good stuff. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have my interview with Peter Beinart about President Biden's trip to the Middle East. So stick around for that.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolet Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, And of course, they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course, they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
I'm thrilled to welcome back to the show Peter Beinart. He is the editor-at-large of Jewish Currents and the author of the fantastic Beinart Notebook on Substack. Peter, it's so great to talk with you again.
My pleasure.
The last time we talked, we were talking all about NATO expansion and how in some ways it wasn't the best idea. The world has changed a little since then. I think that was in January.
Yes, not for the better.
Not for the better. Significantly worse in every way. Well, very different set of topics today. So thank you again, because you know no one's better to talk to on these issues. President Biden's heading to the Middle East in mid-July. He's making stops in Israel and Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, you know, he's attending kind of like the dream summit for the Saudis, right? This is the Gulf Cooperation Council, as well as the leaders of Egypt, Iraq, and Jordan. It's very much a home game for them that Biden will be attending. He's expected to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, the homicidal leader, future leader of the kingdom. I guess then Biden goes to Israel and meets with whoever the hell is in charge of the Israeli government at that moment. Kind of a joke, but not really. And then Biden also meets with Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority. And then, you know, this trip has raised a bunch of human rights questions that I wanted to dig into with you. But first, just a little blocking and tackling. I mean, can you just help listeners understand what the latest sort of machination is with the Israeli government and how this Biden visit works if the government has been dissolved? Like, does he meet with Yair Lapid, if he's the caretaker PM? Do you think Biden will try to do something to, I don't know, buck up someone like Lapid and help push back on someone like Bibi Netanyahu? Like, how would you think about the politics of this?
I mean, my sense is that the fundamental politics of this is that Biden just had to go to Israel sometime in his first term. Right. And he certainly couldn't go to Saudi Arabia without going to Israel. Right. Because as you remember, Barack Obama got in all kinds of trouble for going initially to give that speech in Egypt and not going to Israel. So I think in some ways it was almost kind of like, well, we got to go here at some point. And if we're going to go to see the Saudis, we certainly have to go. So I don't think they knew that the government was going to fall. What it looks like is that there are going to be new elections in late October, early November, probably. And the weirdness of the coalition government that they had was that once Naftali Bennett, once the government fell, the caretaker would be Yair Lapid, who had been the foreign minister, who was supposed to take over, you know, a couple of years from now. So I don't know how much, I'm sure Biden would, you know, be desperately unhappy if Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power to kind of torment him for his last couple of years as president, the way he tormented Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. But I think he has to obviously be pretty subtle about how much he tries to help Yair Lapid, given that the Israelis that Netanyahu's forces won't take kindly to him interfering too overtly.
Yeah, no, and look, Bibi Netanyahu, historically a subtle guy, would never interfere in U.S. elections, would never to Congress, right, give a speech, not right. Tell Obama.
Yes, that's right. He can dish it out, but he doesn't like to take it.
No, that's right. So there's a bunch of human rights issues sort of swirling around this trip, including the murder of two prominent journalists. The first is Jamal Khashoggi. We've talked about Khashoggi a lot on this show. He was executed by the Saudi government in 2018. And then more recently, a beloved Palestinian-American journalist named Shireen Abu Akleh was almost certainly killed by an Israeli soldier in May when she was reporting in the West Bank. Peter, can you just tell listeners a little bit about who Shireen was, what the Israeli government response has been to sort of calls for an investigation into her killing? And then do you expect the Biden administration to push the Israelis on transparency in this investigation? And do you think they should?
Yes, I think they absolutely should. You know, Shireen Abu Akleh was a really iconic Palestinian journalist, someone who had been on TV for a long time, who was just extremely well regarded. You know, tragically and horrifically, a lot of Palestinians get killed all the time in the West Bank, and it usually doesn't barely even makes it into the U.S. media. This was one person, partly because she's an American citizen and partly because she was such an important person who, where it's kind of broken through. And all of the news, you know, all the journalists around her said that that she was shot by Israeli troops. We don't know that she was that specifically targeted by them, but all the evidence points to the fact that it was Israel that did it. And all the evidence suggests that it is very unlikely that if Israel does an internal investigation, that anyone will be held responsible, given the history of Israel's own internal investigations. And by the way, I wouldn't say that's not unique to Israel, right? I don't think America has a very good record in this regard. If you want a serious investigation, you can't have it be done by the same entity that actually killed her, right? The same government, the same military. And I think it's particularly important for this reason. She's an American citizen, and one of the fundamental questions that we are struggling over in the United States essentially has to do with the nature of American citizenship. What progressives are arguing is that we are a country where every citizen should be considered equal. We know that that's not the vision of Trump and the Republican Party, right? For their vision is there are different levels of American citizens, right? There are white Christians, and then there's everyone else. So if the Biden administration essentially says, you know what, we're not going to take Shireen Abu Akleh's murder as seriously as we would some other American who wasn't Palestinian. What you're actually doing is you're giving in to the Trump vision of what American citizenship actually means, which is that it's an ethno-nationalist religious category. It's not a legal category. And that's, I think, really dangerous.
Yeah. And listen, Shireen is like Tim Russert plus Diane Sawyer. Like, she is a famous, revered, beloved, you know, I've heard people talk about how kind she was, how great she was. Like, she's a beloved figure in an American citizen. And what's interesting is, like, I don't see a lot of debate happening about whether Biden should be visiting Israel or not, given that this situation hasn't been resolved, given that the Israelis are stonewalling an investigation into the shooting of Shireen Abu Akleh until their demand is that the Palestinian Authority turns over the bullet that actually killed her that was dug out of her skull, which is obviously, I think, an absurd precondition to start an investigation. You could go interview a bunch of people. You could look at video footage like the AP, the New York Times, Bellingcat, a bunch of folks have done investigations into that. But there is a lot of debate about whether Biden should go to Saudi Arabia at all. And I just do think that that's interesting.
Right. I mean, the problem is that we've gotten into this habit in the United States where we say, listen, we represent democracy and freedom and all those good things against our adversaries, the Russians and the Chinese. And when it comes to Ukraine, the litmus test for whether you really believe in democracy is whether you're going to take our side against the Russians. Fine, right? But then when it comes to Israel, right, which Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the same human rights organizations that we rely on to basically legitimize the view that what Russia is doing in Ukraine is really, really horrible, and what China is doing in Hong Kong and Xinjiang are really, 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 really horrible, right? That we look to, and also Israel's own main human rights organization, B'Tselem, when they call Israel an apartheid state, we just kind of put a big bracket around that and say, well, we're just not really going to look over there, right? And so other people around the world look at us and say, come on, you're total hypocrites. You're thinking, you're saying that that you're going to say that we don't really believe in democracy because we're not taking your side on Ukraine. Well, how about us saying you don't really believe in democracy because you give $3 billion in unconditional military aid to a country that for more than 50 years has held millions of people as permanent non-citizens under military law. And so Joe Biden may not want to deal with the difficult politics of taking on Israel. I totally get that. But you can't pretend that the rest of the world is just going to put on its blind just because you've decided you have blinders on this subject.
Yeah, it's hard up there on that high horse sometimes. So on this question of going to Saudi Arabia and Biden's meeting with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who is, you know, we know from reports about U.S. intelligence directly responsible for ordering the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, where do you land on whether Biden should make this visit? You know, I mean, it's interesting. Everyone knows this is about energy and asking the Saudis to pump more oil. When pressed on it, though, Biden basically says, well, I'm trying to get to broker a Middle East peace deal, which I'm not sure I necessarily believe that. But where do you land on this trip generally?
Well, I've also seen some reports that suggest, I mean, I'm not an energy analyst, but that the Saudis don't actually have that much oil that they can actually pump out right now. Mm-hmm. I think there are a number of things. I think it's partly that the Biden administration does want to build on the Abraham Accords. I think they're under a lot of pressure from Congress to do that. I think they think it would be good politics to do that. I don't really think, to be honest, that makes the world a much better place. I mean, basically what you have is an alliance of a lot of really repressive governments that are getting together to help one another repress each other. You know, Israel is helping the Saudis and the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, repress their own citizens. They're also, it's important to remember this, it's not just that Saudi Arabia is authoritarian and brutal at home. Saudi Arabia is a regional wrecking ball in terms of efforts to promote democracy around the region. And this is something that you and Ben have talked about a lot. I mean, they were intimately involved in the coup in Egypt. They've been involved in the coup in Sudan, the coup in Tunisia. Every place that the democracy in the Middle East fails, you can generally see the Emirati and the Saudi fingerprints on it. So this is the kind of regime that we're going to. I'm not saying that the Biden administration can't have any, you know, should not have anything to do with the Saudi government. That's probably unrealistic. But I don't think you need to actually go and kiss the ring. I think they're doing that partly because they want an alliance against Iran, and that's partly because they weren't actually willing to, I don't think they were willing to move boldly enough to restore the Iran nuclear deal. And I also think it's because they have this very Cold War posture vis-a-vis China, and that gives MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, this kind of leverage to keep saying, well, if you don't give me everything I want, I'm going to go over to the Chinese side. I think it's partly a product of this kind of Cold War mentality that has really taken over the Biden administration.
You know, it's interesting you brought up the pressure to do more on the Abraham Accords. There is some speculation that something more will happen there. Maybe the Saudis will create some sort of rapprochement with Israel. I guess, you know, the Abraham Accords are often sort of reported on as de facto good because, you know, obviously we want countries in the Middle East to have better relations with Israel, to have less hostile relations, to not be sort of in these cold wars. That is a good thing. But there is some question, to your point earlier, about marrying up autocratic regimes, and the Abraham Accords maybe becoming kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card that absolves you of previous sins, like the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And that worries me.
Absolutely. Again, this is the point that I've heard you and Ben talk about before. But one of the things that's happened is that because of the Abraham Accords, you essentially have the pro-Israel organizations in Washington, AIPAC and their other groups, essentially now being very, very pro-Saudi, very, very pro-Emirati, and essentially carrying water for these really, really brutal regimes. Remember, also, we greased the wheels of this by sending these very advanced F-35 planes to the Emiratis, who are a really bad actor across the region, by giving Morocco permission to basically annex Western Sahara, which is complete violation of international law, by undermining the very fragile transition to democracy in Sudan. And I think that the justice question here, which is the fundamental one, you know, peace without justice isn't something which is really that valuable. Ultimately, what makes peace sustainable and valuable is when there's some kind of justice. The questions of justice here are justice for the Palestinians who lack the most basic rights and justice for the people who suffer under these brutal regimes. You know, we've talked about Jamal Khashoggi, but there are many other dissidents in Bahrain, in the UAE, in Saudi Arabia who are being brutalized by this. And what the Abraham Accords do is it actually makes it much easier for all of these regimes to not have to respond to the desires of basic rights from their people. And I would even go as far as to say that in the long term, I know this is not a conventional view, in the long term, I'm not even sure this is going to be good for the relationship between Israelis and people in the rest of the Middle East. And I'll tell you why. If you remember, one of the reasons that some people in the Middle East hated the United States so much, why? Because they saw that the United States was helping to prop up their brutal dictatorial regimes, right? Well, so now a lot of people in the Middle East can see that Israel is helping to prop up their brutal dictatorial regimes, right? Including through this kind of surveillance software that they sell that helps these regimes find and then torture dissidents. Over the long term, I'm not sure that that's actually going to bring us to the true kind of peace and reconciliation that we want between Israelis and other people in the Middle East.
I think that's a really important point to surface, and not one that I think I've heard anyone else make, frankly. All right, I'm going to be a hack for a second. That's kind of my home base. Try to play devil's advocate. See if I can convince you. You and I both just watched 2 hours of a January 6th committee hearing where we saw that, you know, Donald Trump was basically one Secret Service member away from storming the Capitol himself. You know, like all the people who poo-pooed the insurrection, poo-pooed the coup are right. A lot of egg on their face these days, a lot of ketchup on their face if Donald Trump was throwing the plate. So you're Joe Biden. You're getting told by your pollsters, your political advisors, the gas prices don't go down. We are dead. Going to get destroyed at the midterms. This might happen anyway, by the way. Then Biden's going to lose the presidency. We're going to usher in a second Trump term. Isn't that a worse outcome for human rights than going to Saudi Arabia, kissing the ring, bringing gas down 50 cents a gallon, and I don't know, trying to salvage something here? That's my hack attempt at an argument.
No, I think, you know, I thought a lot about this because this is the kind of argument that can come up in so many different circumstances, right? When you're talking about, obviously, the Democratic Party is a better party for democracy and many other things than the Republican Party. And so one can often get into this logic of, well, if this is what the Democrats need to do, even if it's pretty ugly, in order to try to be able to survive politically, then one should support it. I guess where I come down is that's just not my line of work. I mean, I'm not a political strategist. I'm a journalist. So, you know, I write for a living. And it seems to me my job is in a tiny, tiny little way to try to kind of like create some countervailing pressure on the other side, right? Against all of the pressure that Joe Biden's feeling from, you know, all these Republicans who basically couldn't give a darn about the rights of Palestinians or Saudis for that matter, because all they want is basically, you know, some country to basically help us against Iran and kind of do our bidding in this global Cold War. And so I think that there may be other people for whom those conversations make sense, but I think it's, to me, as if you're a journalist and a writer, it's a little bit dangerous to go down that rabbit hole because you kind of lose your moral bearings a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. Peter, here's another pitch for you. if you really want oil and gas and more of it on the market, I've heard just through the grapevine that Venezuela and Iran have access to that as well. What about being nicer to them?
Yes. And I think that I want to be clear what the
I'm obviously being glib here, but like,
right. But I mean,
like there are other options.
People would say, well, yeah, but like their governments are totally abusive and brutal and authoritarian too. Absolutely. But
correct.
I think part of what gets lost often in these conversations is the distinction between having relations with a bad government and arming a bad government, right? I don't have a problem with the U.S. having normal diplomatic relations with bad regimes, whether they're in Iran or Venezuela or even in Saudi Arabia. Now, we should try to use our efforts to try to promote human rights. I think it's right. And if there's a broad-based call amongst those people in those countries for sanctions of some kind, we should listen to them, especially if those are not sanctions are going to be targeted against a small number of people, not the whole population. But what we're doing in Saudi is actually arming this regime. We've been doing it for many years now, even as it produces this horrendous humanitarian situation in Iran. And one of the reasons we are more dependent on Saudi Arabia and they have more leverage over us is because we have no relationship with the government of Iran. I think we'd be, and I think what Obama was going for, I think, was to have a kind of more normal relationship. We weren't going to be allies with Iran. We certainly were not going to give them weapons, for any goodness sake, but to have a more normal relationship would mean that the Saudis and the Emiratis had less leverage over us. And I think that would be a much better policy for U.S. interests. And I actually also think it would be a better policy for human rights in general.
Peter, this is why everyone should read Jewish Currents and the Beinart Notebook on Substack, because you're going to see great journalism, read great journalism, and get exposed to ideas that aren't the conventional kind of blobby thinking in Washington. So thank you for coming on today, for talking with me. I always read your stuff. I always learn something, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks again to the January 6th committee for dropping that surprise episode on us.
Yeah, that was like a pretty good bonus episode.
That was a good bonus. Yeah. Thanks to Peter Beinart for joining the show. Ben, I was off for a week. I asked you for book recommendations. I started one of the Le Carre books. I forget the name of it. You recommended
the Smiley trilogy. I do, you know, so
yeah,
Tinker Tailor, Honorable Schoolboy, and Smiley's
Honorable Schoolboy is what I've
Love that one.
It's fantastic so far.
Stick with it, by the way. It gets better and
okay.
better.
As no, it I'm into it.
Builds.
But I first read a book called The Flag and the Cross, which is about white Christian nationalism and the threat to American democracy. Because I was like,
good
beach
vacation
read.
Reading.
Yeah, yeah, fun. The good news about it, it's short. It's like 3 hours.
What was your best meal? I mean, if you're in France.
The best meal. So we went to... So Hannah's sister is dating a guy, husband for a while, who's French.
It's great.
So we travel like a local.
Love that. Yeah.
So we were like just in Paris for a night, and then we took a train to this little place called Île de Ré. It's an island where like a lot of locals go, a lot of Brits go. And you basically like ride a bike around, and you go to almost a literal shack, and you get seafood that like came out of the water like over there. You drink, you know, a glass of a bottle of wine that costs 7 euros
and
all the
better
mussels.
Better than like Chateau Neuf de Pop.
Swear to God, had both on this trip. And like the best lunch I've ever, one of the best meals I've ever had in my life was just like all seafood, the cheapest bottle of wine on the menu.
Oh,
and it was the best.
That's some real Eat, Pray, Love shit. Right
it was
there.
The best. And it's also like, you know, sometimes when you're abroad and you can't speak the language and you just kind of feel like an asshole.
Yeah.
Because like even the French I kind of know in my head, when pressed,
yeah,
I go right to fake sign language.
Yeah.
Or you speak English with an accent.
Yeah, and you feel like an idiot because like in every other country, people speak English. And
Yeah.
I always mean, feel like a dumbass.
Yeah, I mean, Melanie's boyfriend, Roth, like he's from Strasbourg. He's like fluent in English, French, German, knows some Spanish, could probably dabble in Italian. I'm like, God damn it. This guy's like handsome and cool and knows seven languages. And I'm just like dead weight over here.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got a podcast.
You got two podcasts. There is something tough about telling people, you know, they ask, what do you do for a living? And you're like, I'm a podcaster.
It's hard to explain in some cultures.
Sound cool.
In some cultures, it doesn't translate, you know?
So like, it's like radio?
Yeah,
sort of. It's radio podcast. On your phone?
Yeah.
I don't know. People seem to like it, I guess.
Yeah.
My mom subscribes. Anyway.
Apple or Spotify or anywhere else.
Yeah, wherever else you want to hear my bullshit. All right. Talk to you guys next week.
See ya.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. Saul Rubin is our associate producer. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montooth, who upload our episodes and videos at youtube.com/crookedmedia.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course, they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course, they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.